Hey, and welcome to the River Talk Podcast, a podcast hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weissa. This week, we're talking about kind of whatever the hell we feel like. We're in the time of COVID. Things are happening. Most of us haven't left our homes or seen other people. We probably started drinking sometime in the middle of the day, and who knows where this is going to go. We also brought in Aaron Lieberman because we figured, why not? So let's start with news of the day, and then we'll just make up some topics. So, guys, do you have any news of the day or week or whatever? I don't know what time's doing anymore. So
time is just a concept. I think Zach and, well, all of us have kind of been involved in stuff for Guides and Outfitters. And Zach, I think, has been more intimately involved in this. But Senator Ron Wyden in Oregon just proposed a piece of legislation that would provide specific relief for guides and outfitters that have been struggling through the pandemic. So if you're a guide and outfitter or just generally or a guide owner, someone that generally enjoys those things, we'd love having some support, spreading the word over social media, tagging Senator Wyden and saying you appreciate it and hoping it moves forward. Because that kind of stuff really does make a difference once there's some popularity and traction on social media.
Absolutely. Thanks, Priscilla. So just want to really briefly mention our sponsor of this episode, Sotar. Sotar has been super generous to help sponsor the show, to help pay some of the bills associated with doing a podcast. So thank you, Sotar. And just mention, you know, they have a lot of great products. I'm particularly stoked on the Sotar Stealth Kayak. It's a new kayak they have that's super lightweight. I think it's like 9 or 10 pounds, 12 pounds, something like that. But it's just incredibly awesome of them to like go out and find the fabrics, design a new boat, create something new for our industry. And so thanks, Sotar, for innovating, for doing state-of-the-art stuff, and also for sponsoring the show.
I think that Aaron probably has some news from over in Idaho.
Oh, I got some news. Yep. So I thought we were not doing the COVID stuff. That's okay. Idaho's doing stage two. They're opening bars early, which is an interesting move that probably has to do with the lieutenant governor owning a bar and the head of the party in Idaho also owning a bar. I'm not against it altogether. I mean, whatever.
I like that you said the party of Idaho.
There's the one, right? if anybody doesn't know which party I'm talking about, then you definitely are from Idaho and for sure don't get out much. So also on the national level though, there's another bill out from Senator Manchin in from West Virginia that would Zach, you were talking about the Wyden bill. This is a different angle, but it would take the existing PPP program and extend forgiveness for the use of those funds through August 25th, where otherwise the deadline for actually spending and getting forgiveness for any funds, so say for keeping guides on, which is really the primary application for outfitters, would be limited to June 30th currently. There's already a good amount of bipartisan support, including like Romney in Utah and some others. So another thing for folks to do who are listening, who are guides in particular, is to reach out to your congressional delegation and tell them to support that one. I'll leave it there.
The focus on a lot of this stuff is, you know, guides are seasonal workers. A lot of them can't get unemployment for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's living in a different state than you work. Sometimes you're in school or you haven't worked for 9 months. And right now, a lot of the efforts are trying to get some sort of relief for guides and how to do that. And so that Manchin's bill helps extend PPP benefits. And those of you that don't know what PPP are, it's fine. Don't worry about it. It's a way we can help keep people employed. And it helps string that out over the summer versus just like right now.
Yep. Yeah. And it's worth noting that in our industry guides going back to work or guides receiving a paycheck is also really important for the state and for their community. So like we just got the Idaho Department of Commerce to do some updated economic modeling, and the guide portion of the contribution of guides in Idaho to the overall state economy is about a third of a million or a third of $1 billion in terms of induced spending and like their job multipliers. So it's pretty huge that way. Like when we keep those people on, it's not just about the outfitter. It's about like where those guides live, their communities, all that stuff too.
Yep.
Yeah. So I called people. I feel like every time I tell people in like a newsletter or like things like this to call people, that they're just like, oh, well, my neighbor will do that. You know, it's like the people who other people do that thing. But you should just assume that other people won't take the time, which is not a lot, to do it. So you should do it if you're listening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really right. You know, that one of the things I was telling somebody the other day, like working with outfitters has been this incredible experience. And this is like numerous times I've seen this, but I feel like we're seeing it now really vividly. I was like, you know, you'd think like a bunch of river guides and hunting guides and all this stuff would be a bunch of like backwoods hillbillies who can barely read, which it probably has some truth to it. But at the same time, like you put something in front of us that's hard or an obstacle or something like that, none of us sit very well. We all like to do something. And this group of people like makes things happen and can call up governor's offices and like really act. And it's through sort of that action that things actually happen. And I think we're seeing really cool stuff happen in both Oregon and Idaho and nationally, because outfitters are incapable of sitting still and call and are happy to call and write and do things. And it makes a difference.
Yeah.
So jump on board with us and start calling.
Yeah. I'm gonna belabor this point just one more time, because Eric, I really agree. Those who know me will know that I'm kind of a cynic by nature. Like I'm not, you know, it takes a bit to get me inspired, but it's been really, not much has been cool with COVID. Like not much of it has been cool or fun. But one thing that has been really cool is to see like just how fired up and motivated like our community gets, and like that also includes like folks who aren't outfitters or guides, like just people who want to go out and be able to access public lands, but definitely outfitters and guides. Like I've gotten a couple calls recently from the governor's office where we've moved some pretty big things, and like the explanation was like, yeah, we just got inundated. Like we got hit hard. Like people were calling, people were sending us letters, and that's what does it. So if you're asking yourself whether or not to do it, definitely do. But if you're an outfitter guide, it sounds like you're probably already doing it anyway.
Sweet. Any other news of the week, guys, ladies, people?
The one everybody probably knows, the Rogue closes tomorrow.
Yeah, everybody launched today, so it's fine.
I bet.
all the people launched today.
What was that like?
So,
Eric, you're down.
40-day trip.
Like today's actually not that bad. We've picked up like 28 cars or something for shuttles, but it's not like last weekend. Last weekend may have been one of the busiest weekends. I mean, I've been doing Rogues like shuttles and working on here a long time. I think last weekend may have been the single busiest weekend I've ever seen. Wow. Like we have never in the history of me, I've been doing this, 18 years or something. We have never stopped taking cars for shuttles for the Rogue. Ever. And we did last weekend. Typically, like we've been close to having our parking lot full here before, like in the summer when we have guides parked inside, customers parked inside, and all those shuttle cars fill in the lot. Like we've been down to like the last couple square feet trying to get the gate closed. And we were genuinely concerned with no guide cars, no guest cars, just shuttle cars, that we weren't going to fit all the cars in the lot last weekend. It was bananas down here. Yeah, no, this weekend, I mean, the weather, I think, kind of turns some people away. It's kind of like marginal down here. But yeah, the road closes tomorrow. So sad.
Yeah.
Sad. As everything else is opening up, the Rogue is closing down.
Yeah.
It makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's
it's just so contrary to like the Southern Oregon ethos, too. Like, Remember, so like folks, anybody, like I know everybody on this call has seen it or was there, but anybody listening, there's this place in Southern Oregon called the Militant Hippie, which I feel like really encapsulates the spirit of Southern Oregon. You know, it's like bongs and like army surplus in the same store. You can buy like a big hatchet next to a sneak pipe, you know?
The guy you buy stuff from.
And like, I feel like that really, really, really like captures the spirit of the place. And it's so contrary that like that would be the place where the river closes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Hopefully that's something, a few of us were on a call today expressing concerns about that to some of the governor in Oregon's natural resource staff and working with the Office of Outdoor Recreation. And I know that the Rogue has not been the only place that has had issue working with federal entities when it comes to rivers that require a permit system. So it seems like
there's... Let me ask you, go ahead. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Priscilla.
So you guys
are in Oregon. You guys are in Oregon. Like, give me your take on, like, here's a great example of like a test case for an Office of Outdoor Rec. Like, mm-hmm. in your experience so far in the age of COVID, mm-hmm. like, this is where I would expect an Office of Outdoor Rec to really like step up and shine, right? Like, what is the purpose of an Office of Outdoor Rec if not to defend outdoor rec in a time in the age of COVID? Like, what are your takes on the utility of an Office of Outdoor Rec?
So I want to cut this just for what, real quick. Let's make this like a 30-second conversation, okay. Because we've got cooler draining to talk about.
Yeah, right.
And we're starting to delve into language.
For sure. Yeah.
Like, you're using terminology that our average user is like, what's an Office of Outdoor Rec?
Yeah. I can do my elevator pitch real quick, because I have to justify this position constantly, because I helped manage one of the orgs that lobbied for it to be created in the first place. So this has been an incredible test for that office existing. And the person who is in that job right now, Kaylin O'Brien Feeney, has done an incredible job in getting recreation users to the table where they ordinarily would have kind of been, in my opinion, a side thought for our executive administration and our agencies. So there are obviously some places lacking because he is an office of one with a very limited budget. But I think overall he's done an incredible job of being proactive and engaged and, you know, working overtime remotely with multiple groups and agencies and achieving what he can and, you know, working overtime to get the perspectives of those stakeholders that are having issues. So as far as I can tell, the only place that he has had trouble is with engaging with the federal entities, which we're not the only state that has had that issue. So overall,
it would be a bad story.
I know
we're keeping this short, and I will. I'm just going to pop in real quick and say my sympathy level for a person in an office of one with a large budget is super low. Oh, did you have a huge budget that you had to manage in your office of one?
I think you misheard me. An office of one with no budget.
Yeah. Oh, well, so, I would imagine his budget's a little bit different than mine.
He literally has no budget. I know this because
I'm writing IOUs to utility companies.
We can talk about this on another podcast, but that's my two cents.
Great. Should we move on to talking about boating and things?
Let's talk about the fun.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Let's see. Zach, let's start. Somebody pick one of Zach's like topics and we'll start here.
Who feels passionate about one?
Oh, man. I think these were all good.
So the deal with today's podcast is literally just, we wanted to get together and just chat and not about COVID. We've done a terrible job at it so far.
We did that.
We just want to debate topics. And so I came up with 14 possible topics we could debate. I'll throw it out there. I'll just start it.
This is number 10. This is so good.
Is raft racing lame?
Oh, there's a good one.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, agreed.
Definitely. So, can we move on?
No, hold on. Okay. I think I'm going to put two caveats on that. One, it is super lame if it's on a run that has any flat water. So, like, when the race is won or lost on flat water, then super lame.
If it's a pretty much nonstop, like, you know, top to bottom, like Gore Fest. I think Gore Fest is a good example. Pretty much all of that race is pretty rowdy whitewater, and that's rad. Like, that's a cool race.
Yeah.
But a run like, I don't know, there's so many of them. Like, don't get me wrong, Clackfest is a blast. But from a race so standpoint, that is super lame. Like, it's just, who's the person who's been out there paddling on flat water in a canoe to get in shape? Like, that's who wins that race. It has nothing to do with how good of a boater you are. It has to do with how much cardio you've been doing.
We know who has.
we know.
You guys, have you guys seen? So everybody's seen Dodgeball, right? Like, so the team, they're like the stand-ins for like Aryan youth, who are just like training all the time. They like own the gym. Oh, yeah. Like, those are the people that win raft races. It's not because they're better. It's because they work out all the time.
Well, that's who wins Clackfest.
Yeah. I do think head to head mass start, like R4, is one of the most fun things ever. Like, even if there is a little bit of flat water, but not a lot, and everyone's just like there mostly to be competitive in a fun way, it's super fun to like try to knock your buddies out of the boat or like get them stuck on rocks so that you can pass them. Like, I think one of the most fun races I've done was actually R2, but low water Canyon Creek, Washington. And it was a mass start and it was hilarious.
Yeah. I think the mass start ones, again, less flat water, the better. Mm-hmm. So like no flat water, but mass start, is the, any, you know, even that one's kind of fun with flat water, but yeah. Like that's where it's at, is the mass start chaos. People are bouncing into each other. Like,
yeah,
I remember that we did the first King of the Rogue one.
Yeah,
it was like one where we had it was like there was like multiple boats at the same time, and it was a blast. Like, it was super fun. And that one had involved carrying rafts across rocks at some point. Like, that was sort of sketchy, but and fun. But
that was fun.
Yeah, that was. I think the mass starts are fun.
Yeah.
So I think we all generally agree so far that it's lame. But Zach, let's get your take, and then let's move on because I like some of these topics.
So I think that I have answers for all of these that are correct. So I'm going to let you guys debate them and try the answer. I think that as you were seeing, I think I'm with Priscilla on head.
No, I take it back. Let's move on to the next one.
Give me my 20 seconds.
Okay.
I agree with Priscilla about head-to-head, but not R4 racing. I like R2 racing more because both people are engaged in making decisions. When you're R4 racing, there's basically a guide saying what to do. I think R2 racing, both people are actively engaged. So I'm a huge fan of R2 racing. I do think there needs to be some flat water, though. And this might seem weird because there's a certain element of luck as to how it starts. And the flat water helps separate people in shape from out of shape. So, like, on the wind, when it's an R2 race and there's 20 boats, you know, the starting position will be really close to the end position if there's no flat water. That's just my two cents.
Not if the people who are in a good starting position are crappy boaters and get stuck on a rock somewhere. So,
yeah, but if all things equal, what happens is if the two best teams are ones at the start and ones at the end, you know,
the right. One, I see what you're saying.
You have to like fight your way. It's really fun to fight your way through the pack, but if there's just no way you can win because there's no way to separate yourself, that's troublesome. So
yeah,
I don't mind some
flat. So Zach, I will say, I think I like your point about the R4 versus R2, unless you're the quote unquote guide in R4. And then you just have other people to yell at. And so I think that's a lot of fun.
It's super fun to yell at people, but it's also really hard to find three people to yell at.
Yeah.
Like in R2 race, I'll find a partner that day. I'll call somebody up that day before who wants to, it's really easy to find a second person. But to find three people to yell at is a lot of work.
All right. Should we move on to...
Yeah.
Oh, can we do number 12? Let's do number 12.
Okay, I'll do number 12. All right. How come Covey can only stack 6 boats? That seems like a really low number.
So if you don't know, Covey Box, a friend of ours here in Southern Oregon. I've known Covey for, gosh, probably 20 plus years now. And he's sort of a local legend, like local boating legend. I remember growing up, he was a little older than me, and he was like the kayaker of Southern Oregon. He was like the one guy that wasn't quite pro, but was better than everybody else. And at that time, we had a decent number of pros living in Southern Oregon, so there was sort of a distinction there. But he, a couple of years back, did a, he stacked six rafts. He started with two. He took two rafts, strapped them on top of each other, and then ran sort of this classic little class four section that we do here with his two rafts stacked on top of each other. And then a couple of years ago, and I'm sure if you're ever on the social medias, you've seen this, he stacked six rafts together and took them down that same stretch. So it was, you know, sort of an all-star move. The question is, can he stack? Why does he stop at six?
I mean, the question is, anybody can stack six boats. Like, I want to see.
I think it's the oar length.
I want to be impressed. I want to see eight or nine.
I mean, yeah, like, so as my brother would always say, if you're not breaking records, what's the point? And
it's one of my favorite phrases.
Yeah, right. I mean, he's a champion. It is what it is.
Here's the better question. How,
like, if you're not doing double digits,
how do you get up on top of those?
Ladder.
Do you think he's limited by a ladder? Yeah. Do you think he's limited by a ladder? Like, was it just he couldn't find a big enough ladder?
I think just I was gonna say be a man. That's not gender appropriate.
Can't say that, Priscilla. Wow.
Be a human. Come on, Priscilla. Be a human and climb up the damn straps.
That sounds lame.
I just, you know, those things you used to cut, you like, you rent them and you put yourself in them and you press the remote control and they push you in the air. Whatever those are called.
Oh, yeah. Like lift.
A scissor lift.
Yeah, you just get a scissor lift.
Just get a scissor lift.
Either way.
Oh, yeah. You just find a scissor lift in Gold Hill.
You can rent those in Grants Pass.
Dude, you can rent those at, you can totally rent those.
Yeah. I don't know how that would limit Covey. Here's what I think. We should just go do like 10 boats just to get it done.
Record it.
Yeah.
Send it to Kobe. Yeah. Challenge. Yeah.
Well, we have more topics here. I think the takeaway is Kobe, we're not impressed by six. It was an okay try, and you know.
We were entertained at first, but right? Not
double digits when it'll start to get impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there's really not a big difference between two and six. It's still a single digit number.
Yeah. We'll bring you back to the pot at 10.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fair.
All right, next number.
Okay.
I'll just pick. Number one, to drain or not drain your cooler?
Oh, geez.
I'm really curious on this one, actually.
I mean, there's the scientific answer, and then there's the sanitation answer.
But if you package things appropriately in your cooler, sanitation is not an issue. If you just have like loose meat and unsealed Ziplocs, then it's gross.
Loose meat?
You just have Jesus. A big stack of ribs in there just floating in the water.
Just don't go the opposite direction of putting your ground beef in a Ziploc. Yeah. Just take it out of the package and dump it in the cooler. Is that what we're talking about? Yeah. Well, I think that's a different question.
I think
whether or not it is a good idea to put your meat directly on ice in your cooler on a multi-day rafting trip.
So
I hope these are not taken out of context.
So according to Pete,
the veggies and like other just stuff.
Yeah.
So according to Pete, his argument is that according to the law of thermodynamics, it is better to leave the water in your cooler so that your ice will melt slower if you do that. Is that what I'm understanding, or am I misunderstanding his argument?
The second law of thermodynamics in particular, which I'm not sure if that's the one he meant to reference. I think it's the first, but when you drain the water out, you're removing like a mass that's basically cold. And so if you want the cold in your cooler to last the longest, you won't remove that ice. It has the ability to absorb heat. Let's put it that way. So you're removing your ability to absorb heat by removing that cold water. And since
really easily, just take two glasses and put ice in them and then drain the water out of one and see which one melts faster.
Yep. So if your goal is to keep the cooler colder for longer, you want the water in there. If that's not a priority, like you're like, no, I'm only doing a 3-day trip, I'm good. It doesn't matter. But then you also don't want your meat, you know, floating around in a bunch of water. But it's not just meat, Priscilla. It's like
your veggies.
Yeah.
Veggies get gnarly if they're sitting in the water. Yeah. I think that's actually the one
that's
half and half.
Here's the solution to that, which, to be honest, I have only recently found out about because friends who have way nicer gear than me have this, is the veggie tray. You have the tray that elevates the veggies and, like, stuff with cardboard, like eggs, above all of that.
Yeah, it's just, like, that works for the average person going out for the weekend.
But you can get giant ones, or just creative.
No, I mean, I have one of those canning coolers with the trays that hang in there, like for my personal cooler.
Yeah.
It's badass. I love it. But it does limit, just because of the way they sit in there, you can't fit as much in the cooler at the end of the day. But one of the things you can do is there's companies out there that make, they're like ice blocks sort of things. They're like the reusable ice blocks, but they're made of something besides, like some water mixed with some sort of chemical. So they freeze at a lower temperature and those last a lot longer. And then they don't drain into your stuff. So yeah, if you really want to go
the right route,
spend a bunch of money and get these like super ice blocks that don't drain. But yeah.
I think the answer is like A, Pete is right. Cause thermodynamics, but it ultimately depends on whether or not you're putting your like raw meat in like loosey goosey or like whether or not your veggies are just like disintegrating and you have room for trays. Like case by case, you're gonna have to make like a game time decision. Like how messed up is this cooler right now? How much does that have to do with water? If it has to do with water, let's get rid of the water.
That's the answer to every one of our questions, except for how come Kobe can only stack six boats. Every answer is going to be it depends.
Yeah. I think another question on the Kobe one is, did he have to stack them himself? Because if so, six is pretty impressive.
He has minions.
Back to that one, I think the ultimate limiter on that one is how long can your oars be?
Well, no, because he had like, the PVC pipes to connect them, right?
Yeah, but
takes long oars.
Do the oars even matter?
Yeah, I mean, the way he went through, mm-hmm. the way he went through Powerhouse, they sure didn't.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's a challenge, Cody. That's a challenge.
Maybe the taller people less than.
Man, yeah. Okay, yeah. What's the next one, Zach?
We're bringing some thunder today. It's been a long week.
We're not doing it easy. Debatable.
Let's do number two.
Taking COVID out on Kobe.
Or a good thing.
Training wheels.
Oh man, training wheels.
Well, wait. There's a little bit of a misalignment that training wheels are a good thing for someone who is learning.
We've talked about this before.
I think in big water, oar rights, we're talking about like the little plastic things that your oars set into, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So in big water, like Greenwall, I think oar rights would be a good thing generally, because
why not just use pins and clips at that point?
But does that keep your pins and clips keep your oar at a certain angle, or is that
yes? Well, then they keep it from sliding in or out, so they're actually like handles that you can hold on to, basically. Like they'll help you in the boat.
Okay, wait. Okay, so.
But I like
yeah. Oar rights are like I have really weak wrists and I don't know how to turn them.
Okay, let's for my own intelligence and understanding, and also for the audience, how about you explain what oar rights are versus what pins and clips are? Because I feel like I'm confused.
This is a Zach question for sure. Please explain, Zach.
So a pin and clip is just a clip that goes around a vertical pin. It keeps the oar blade the same angle, and it also helps keep the oar from popping back at you. Right, and it's something that I would say more old school boaters use, more California boaters use. Although I do understand that oar locks are technology from like a long time ago, but in whitewater, pins and clips are more old school. Oar rights just mainly focus on keeping the blade at an angle. But there are, my friend Dave Nissen with Mad Catter has designed an elastic bungee thing that allows them to keep coming at you, so they can be used for stability too. So if you, just to reiterate, pins and clips give you blade angle being the same, and the keeps the ore from hitting you or coming at you. Ore rights only keep the blade angle being the same, but you can fix that with this special product that's made of Bungie.
Okay. So I guess the thing that makes sense to me is if you're rowing big water where you're likely to have your oar pop or to like have your oar angle change because of the nature of the current, I would want the thing that keeps the oar from popping out as well as keeping the angle. And anything else seems silly unless it's a training tool.
That is absolutely the correct answer.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
Yep. Error number one. I mean, problem with that?
No, that was a good answer.
Eric?
I think that in basically all rowing contexts, with the exception of perhaps the gnarliest of like class five, whatever, open oar locks are hands down the most efficient and what should be the goal. I can understand oar rights being used as training wheels to give someone a sense of how to row so that they can sort of focus on like one thing at a time in their learning. But the goal should be to graduate to the big leagues and properly row a boat. Yeah. That's what I think.
What Eric's trying to say is it like for those lesser folks, you know. If you're meek of spirit and of physique, what Eric's saying is then you might want to consider some training wheels, you know?
No, but if you're cool, I use open oar locks because I am meek of physique and it's easier. It allows me to be lazier. It decreases the likelihood I take an oar to the face or get tossed out of the boat. Like, it's just easier and more efficient. And because I'm lazy and meek in physique, I like open oar locks.
Not everyone's for goth.
I kind of feel like I'm wearing like a shirt that's too tight. If I have anything limiting my oar locks, you know, it's like I feel like I just want to tear it off. Like it's, you know what I mean?
Superman style. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I get that a lot actually, but yeah.
All right, so we try to hit that one. Next one, Zach. Where are we going?
Let's do.
We got like three more, maybe.
Let's do number.
Can we just hit Google versus Apple because it's easy?
Sure.
Oh, no. That's not a boating thing. Come on.
That's not a
okay.
Boating.
Whatever. Okay. It's Apple. So next.
Well, then before we go on, I just want to. I can't help myself. I'm trying to not say anything. With your or comment on the or rights being the goal, I'm going to respectfully disagree. I'm gonna say that open oar locks work until like easy class four, and then you need to have your blade angles the same. I just want to say those words. I don't think I say like it's not for the hardest. I would say mid class four, that's where having your blade angle at the same helps.
I would somewhat
you can say it,
but
cool. I want the words.
That doesn't make it true, but you can say it. Yeah, I appreciate you saying it.
Okay, let's move on to number 13. Is whitewater sup a fad that's now over?
Ooh.
I think it might be.
I hope so.
Does anybody still whitewater sup other than Sup Paul? And I don't think Sup Paul's
doing whitewater supping. I mean, if his Instagram feed is anything, one, that dude boats more than any person I've ever met in my life.
He gets up.
And two... apparently it's still kind of a thing, like the class three level, class two, three level, which I think is right where it should be. Like, I think whitewater supping at like the class two plus level is super fun. So, you know, if you want to go swim down a river, like it's a great option. So
I think it's done the thing that most like innovative so-called technology has done is it's like, it's kind of settled into what it kind of should have been, at least if you're talking about the majority, is like there's still going to be people that push it in terms of difficulty and actually enjoy the whitewater component, like Sup Paul and then Paul Meyer, other Sup Paul.
That's right. That's two different people.
There's
I totally
two.
About that.
There's two. Yeah.
It's a Paul thing.
But like, I have a lot of friends, lady friends, that really enjoy Sup.
Show off.
Oh yeah, I've lost weight. Be jealous.
Oh, I've got a lot of lady friends.
Yeah, I have a ton of friends too, and only half of them are named Pacheco, who is my dog.
Anyway, it's one of those things that I think I can appreciate, because there's been a few times where some of my friends that don't whitewater kayak or whitewater IK, it's like they're able to paddle on some flat water, and I'm able to enjoy them, or they're able to do like the last one or two. What?
This is, just to remind everyone, I'm a guest here, but this is a podcast about whitewater, right? Okay. So they're like,
well, I guess, you know, I won't be able introducing to, they're able to Aaron hit that, to
hit that class done gnar, you know. I think this is actually a really good segue, though, because we're talking about, Priscilla, you mentioned, I think the phrase was innovative boat design. I think it's a really good segue to, Zach, I'm sure there's something in here about
number three,
about boat designs that we disagree on.
Do we want to talk about rocker? Is that what you want to talk about?
We did that last week.
Yeah.
That's okay. It's okay.
I think number three is a good one.
Okay, before we go to number three, I just want to say, if you guys do want to have the talk about boat design, that's one of those examples where you guys can talk about it for a while, and then I'll tell you the answer at the end. But that's a whole episode.
Yeah, well, yeah, next time.
Best way to set up a tarp, can we just all agree that the best way to set up a tarp is to be the person that sits back with the beer and instructs others on how to do it?
Yep. Definitely.
Okay. Nailed it. All right, let's move on to the next one. Yeah.
Okay, number three. What's lamer, creature crafts or pack rafts?
That's tough.
Yeah, that is tough.
I mean, I think pack rafts require some skill to navigate, so.
Got him. Nice. That was a good burn.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. All right, next one. Let's just go to the next one. I think that's it. I think Priscilla got it.
All right. Okay. Number 14. Safety. Okay. Safety PFDs. You guys are talking about the things with the buckles in the front and the rings in the back. Is it a thing?
Oh, like class guide? Five, like rescue.
Rescue vest. Yeah. River guides, like professional guides, need a rescue vest? Or let me rephrase it. Is it at all useful to them in any way?
What kind of guide are they?
A river guide, just regular raft guide.
Raft, IK.
Like if you're a traditional Idaho, Oregon, like big river-ish river guide. Class 3-4-ish river guide.
Probably not necessary then.
I mean, does it hurt?
I wait.
It does if you don't know how to use it.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you don't know how to use it, it can.
I'll tell you how it hurts. Yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot. It weighs 4 ounces. And a half ounces, depending on the setup.
It's a lot to carry.
And you have to buckle it every time.
Yeah.
And
not if you have a pullover.
So, you know, when you're like, waiting for, like, you finish lunch and everybody's in their boats and you're getting ready, and like every guide is ready and there's one more who's just tinkering with their stuff, and you're like, oh, good, they're ready to go. And then they have to put their life jacket on and buckle their thing. Do you guys have that same issue? There's always one slow person.
Yeah.
So that one person is always buckling their safety harness that they never use to make the trip even wait longer. So it's like, to me, it's like it weighs something, it costs more money, and it just takes longer to deal with. That's the downside. And I don't personally see the upside, but I would love for you guys to point the upside up to me so I get it.
I feel like that's just a really big question. Like, safety PFD or not for raft guide? I'd say it depends is the answer. You know?
I think that the odds in the traditional sort of Western multi-day class, you know, like four-ish, like Middle Fork, Main, Lower, Rogue, you know, I think there's probably some harder stuff out there where it's a different conversation. So like if you're a guide on Gore, then we're probably having a different conversation. But if you're the traditional classic multi-day river guide in the West, it feels to me like the chance that you ever utilize that harness in a real way is like 0.001. Like, it's almost non-existent. But if there is a opportunity where it could be helpful, it's nice to have it. But yeah, the odds of that are so slim to make it almost not worth doing.
I'll tell you what, man. Like,
you should take training and know how to use it so you don't kill yourself.
Doing a swiftwater rescue class and rescue swimming using those harnesses on the salmon was an exercise in absurdity. It's like you have to swim so far out to get to the place where the person might be. Yeah. All right. What we got next, Zach?
Okay, I found a boat design one. Number 8, is there one boat that can both be a paddle boat and a gear boat for overnights? So, like, is there one raft you can buy that you can paddle boat down the South Fork of the Payette, basically, and be a gear boat on the road?
Wait, say that again?
Like, one boat design. I think a lot of people, there's people who, like, let's say, paddle boat to the chutes, like private boaters. And they also want to have a gear boat for the Rogue or the Middle Fork of the Main, right? And but they only want to buy one raft. They don't want to buy a paddle boat and a gear boat. They want one raft that can do both.
For like a private, like for your
I think
private,
it's the,
your personal boat.
Yeah, personal boat.
I think it's the NWRC ATV.
That's a ducky.
Is it?
I know.
Hmm.
No,
I feel like you put oars on it. or you put two of them together and it's a cat boat.
Okay, but you can't paddle boat.
You challenge accepted.
Yeah, I mean, I totally think there is.
What's like, that? What's I, that? NRS has like a super wide, 16, right? Does that work for paddle boating? What is that one called?
I think it's the Sotar 14-foot ST. They're like traditional, you know, sort of classic raft, like 14 or 15, somewhere in that neck of the woods. You can paddle boat it, and you can run, basically you can put a frame on it and run pretty much anything you're going to want. Like,
that seems right.
That is the workhorse. And then, I mean, Air has an equivalent. I don't remember exactly what model it is because I can never keep track of all their letters. But
I understand it now.
Probably like the 30D something D.
It's the one, it depends on the size. Like, I've learned it. If it's 140, that means 14 feet. If it's 146, that's 14 feet, 6 inches. So it's not that hard.
Well, but it's the letters, because the letters then talk about the different.
R is regular tubes, like non-diminishing. D is a little bit of diminishing.
Yeah.
Double D is a lot of diminishing.
Yeah. So somewhere in those, like those in a 14-foot length are like the ultimate do all things boat. You can go paddle boat the wind, mm-hmm. or you can go run the Middle Fork with your frame for 6 days. Like those boats will like that 14 and a half foot boat with sort of the traditional tubes is basically a do anything craft. It's the quiver boat. It's going to do everything reasonably well.
I like how you called it the workhorse. I think that's a good description. So you're saying a 14 to 14 and a half foot boat with non-diminishing tubes, that's the boat.
I think so. If you want the do everything boat, yep. It'll do everything reasonably well.
That or the double ATV.
We sold all of our ATVs. We have none of them left.
It's a huge mistake. Yep. It's a huge mistake.
Maybe I can buy them back.
It's that versatile.
Yeah, I'll see if I can buy them all back. All right. Number 7, Chinese made PVC boats versus American made boats.
American made. I mean, we talk about like cost or like.
Is it worth paying double? It's basically double. So would you buy like a Rocky Mountain for $2,000 or a Sotar / Air / Moravia for $4,000 to $5,000? Is the extra money worth it?
I think it depends on a couple of things, like how long you would plan on keeping it, how much are you like, or a couple of things, how long you plan on keeping it, how much you're using it. Do you care about your colors? Like how much customization do you want? You know, are you cool with like the straight off the shelf colors, shape, size, et cetera?
And really the most timely one, are you buying it right now in the age of COVID? Because you're not going to get that for quite a while. If you're getting the PVC from China. right?
Yeah, they're not shipping him probably.
But maybe no, it's not.
But
I mean, a good example to me is like the tributary versus the air, right? The boats are basically the same boat. The material on the air is a little thicker, like a fraction thicker. I mean, it's nominal. But it is probably going to have a hair more durability in the 20 years of the life that you have it. But the ability to customize where you want your D-rings, the exact length you want, the color you want, all of that, you know, for some people is really a big deal. And what you're going to use it for. Whereas if you take the tributary, it's like you're getting the color that they have, and the D-rings are going to be where they're going to be. So, I don't know. Depends what you're using wise, for.
My best, I would guess a tributary. And those of you who don't know, a tributary is Air's. It's a version of Air's boats made in China. So it's less expensive, not the same standards of a regular airboat. My guess is you're going to get half the life out of a tributary.
I mean, like, I would have thought so, but then I have some, we have some tributaries that are like 18 years old or something, and they're holding up fine. Huh? So, you know, what I have seen personally is that they're both a great product. And
I think like an associated question is, how good are you at patching? Like if you're pretty bomber at patching, yeah, PVC, Chinese made for sure.
I mean, it's how good are you at patching and how willing are you to patch?
Yeah, and yeah, how good are you at patching? How willing are you to patch? And how much do you care about how janky your boat looks?
And I think the other piece I would add, is if you want something lightweight, you probably have to go domestic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like the stuff that's made overseas is all really heavy. And so that decreases your performance. It also is a pain if you have to carry it at all. Like, you know.
It's like a Central European lunch.
What?
You know, it's just heavy meats.
Keep going with the mess in this episode.
Well,
hey guys, that was
all right.
We've had, by the way, our answers to these questions. I'm really proud of this episode. I think these are just solid answers. I think our best way to set up a tarp answer was phenomenal. And we only really have
solving problems.
We've been through every single one pretty much. We have one left, I think.
Let's do it.
What are the non-teachable skills required for guiding?
Operation make dinner taste good.
Can you say that slowly?
Operation make dinner taste good. You know, you mess up. Yeah, you mess up. Well, no, like innovating, innovating when you messed up while cooking, or just being personable. But those are two separate ones. I'd say, like, you know, it's like you're making nachos. Left them. You put too many coals in the DO. You're like, well, I need to make dinner taste good. So. Like, I have two options of how to make this happen. I can go make another beer run to the guests and make it taste better that way. Or I can, like, redo dinner.
Wait, let's go back a sec. You make nachos in a Dutch oven?
Have before.
What is that?
Yeah, for a while, actually. Yeah, they're really good. Yeah, when you don't mess it up, it's awesome.
Can you just take a few seconds to talk through this recipe? Because I'm intrigued.
Yeah. So you do all the chopping.
Like most nachos.
Yeah. Actually, Eric and Priscilla could both speak to this one too. But like you do a lot of choppy chop. You know. So you got
choppy chop.
Like I'm gonna skip by the ingredients part. So like you have chips, you have like the veg, you have cheese, definitely, and
my
sometimes
big question,
meats.
Hold on. Do you put a layer of beans at the bottom?
No.
Okay.
You could.
You put some beans. First, bottom layer is chips. Then you got some veg, some cheese. Then like a couple layers up, you start doing some beans. Then you start, you know, you just repeat that until you get to the top, and then you just don't burn it.
How long does it take?
Mm-hmm.
Not very long.
I don't know. Yeah.
If you do this right, yeah.
Is this a meal or an appetizer?
App.
Depends. But yeah, app.
Is this an orange torpedo app?
Yeah, in Mexico.
Not as much as it used to be. We moved away from it, but it was for a long time.
Do you have to start at, like, do you get to camp like 4 p.m. and like, hey guys, go jump on those nachos?
Yeah, no, for sure. That's, yeah. We don't, like I said, we don't do it as much as we used to, but it was a great one. We definitely won't do it this year. It's not going to be a year for nachos.
Why?
So, I mean, I feel like making those nachos is a teachable skill. Like, you guys just taught me how to do it.
It for sure is a teachable skill.
No, 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 yeah. The making of the nachos is the easy part. Like, until you mess it up, that's where it's a non-teachable skill to fix the situation that you created by not doing the nachos correctly, by messing up the nachos. Like, fixing it, really, it's like fixing things that you messed up. Like, how do you fix well, folks are hungry. I definitely burned the living shit out of these nachos. How do I make this better than it is right now? It's like, you know, most people are like, well, we just tell them the nachos burned. But the non-teachable skill is like fix the problem by either getting people, I mean, I'm gonna be honest right now, just like getting people a little bit boozy or redoing dinner. That's not really an option. So you get people a little bit boozy and entertain them.
So are you saying a non-teachable skill for guides is sort of, there's like an ingenuity and a creativity.
It's like David Blaine meets liquor. Meets burned nachos.
Is Blaine always involved?
It feels like there's this,
like, it doesn't, like, it doesn't have to be, but it sure doesn't hurt in his life.
This is one traumatizing experience that Aaron had.
Yeah.
Oh, it worked out just fine.
I think improvising though. It's like, and I,
well, that's, yeah, that's the underlying
thing Aaron, right? Is saying, yeah, is like, what ingredient did you forget, or what other thing did you forget to bring or forget to mention? Your ability to improvise in that moment is going to be pretty important when it comes to the guests' like expectations and overall experience, and then ultimately your tip at the end.
Is this something you can, Eric, this is a question directed at you almost, but not completely. Is this something you can hire for? Or do you think that guides sort of self-select into jobs based on having that skill?
It's a good question.
I think I tell people this a lot, like when we hire folks, because oftentimes I'm hiring people that have very little to no river experience, and then training them. Because, you know, what I say is, like, I can train you to row a boat. I can't train you to talk to adults. And I think there is something inherent generally about people who apply for river guide jobs that more often than not, they're sort of, you know, adventurous spirits who are problem solvers and that kind of thing. But it's, to be a good river guide, you have to have more than river skills. And you kind of have to have a combination of other things. You have to have the ability to hold conversations about non-river related stuff. So, you know, can you talk about, to some extent, I mean, realistically, politics is a thing that you have to be able to converse in. You have to be able to converse in all sorts of things that aren't, you know, how to cook dinner and how to row a boat.
Yeah.
And so those are the things that are hard to teach. You have to hire people who are inherently curious and inherently want to better themselves and are interested in the world and are interested in other people. Like, those are skills I can't teach. I can't teach you to be interested in your guests because you're inherently curious about who they are and what's in their life. Or at least I haven't figured out how to train that.
It's
a thing we have to hire for.
Yeah, we call that being interesting and interested.
Yeah.
If that's a skill.
I think the summary skill set is empathy, ingenuity, and oh man, I had a third one there. What was it? Yeah, really good. At least those two.
The third one is having a good memory.
Charisma. There it is. Empathy, ingenuity, and charisma. You got those things. Hopefully, you can boat a little bit.
Or at least two of the three, because charisma can pull you through a lot. Like,
that's true.
You can solve that nacho problem with charisma.
For sure.
That's what Operation Make Dinner Taste Good is all about. That's what I'm saying.
Charisma? It sounds like it was about booze.
Oh, yeah, but like the charisma to get people to drink booze. I know it's 145 degrees out here, but who wants tequila?
I'm pretty sure I have almost the same story, but it involved the pineapple upside down cake where we ran out of charcoal. And like, that memory still burned in my head.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Zach.
I was going to move on. We actually have one more. We can do it really quick and then go to Gear of the Week and go home.
Really quick.
Yeah. Our number 9 is the last one. Manual versus automatic transmission.
Manual.
What kind of driving are you doing? Are you driving mostly in a city with a bunch of stops and goes, or are you mostly driving like on rural?
This is a river podcast, Priscilla.
River outfitted or truck with a trailer up and down hills.
Manual.
So like Portland.
Manual.
As a guy doing it, manual. As an owner giving that truck to someone else, automatic.
Good distinction.
Good point. Great point.
Good distinction. Yeah.
I'm a manual person, but man, I am totally. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm buying automatics.
Kids today can't drive. I mean, like, we do. It's literally a question in our interviews. It's like question number 3: Can you drive a stick? And it used to be, like, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever. I don't even know how long I've been doing this. It was like 50% or more could drive a stick. And I would bet this year we have at best had one person who could drive a stick.
And they're probably lying.
More than likely, yeah.
And they can barely do it on a car, much less a truck and a trailer.
Yeah, we ask, can you back a trailer? And that's my follow-up question. They say
they
yes.
They honestly interpreted that question as a Harry Potter reference. Like, can you drive a stick? Like, yeah, dude, I play Quidditch. You know what I mean?
Nimbus 3000.
Got some Harry Potter fans out there.
So should we move to Gear of the Week?
Yes, please.
All right. What do we got? Zach?
I have Gear of the next Week. To me a Crazy Bill TV beanie. So I'm pretty proud of this. Do you guys know who Crazy Bill is?
Oh, yeah. Bill Guyman.
Bill Guyman. He was on our podcast a few episodes ago. He was wearing one in some YouTube video he did, so I sent a message saying, hey, can I get one of those beanies? He said, no problem. And he sent me some Crazy Bill TV panties, which wasn't funny. And I wrote him back an email and said, I don't want panties. I want a beanie. And I now have a Crazy Bill TV beanie. So for those of you that want one, just, you know, write him a bunch of messages, tell him how rad he is, because he is rad, and ask him for one of his beanies.
Awesome. Sweet. Priscilla, Gear of the Week.
All right. Box wine. I don't know if that needs explanation.
In the box or just the bag?
The bag.
So you're taking the bag out of the box.
Right. So it works in a kayak or a raft. And then it doubles as a pillow.
So when you pass out from it, you can sleep on it?
Yeah, it's much more comfortable than hugging a box of, like, than hugging a bottle of wine.
That wine makes a better pillow than bottle of wine.
If we
that's
have,
just
we
true.
Have, do we have, do
that's
we have
just true.
Titles? Because if we do, that should be it. There's an episode title in there somewhere. Great. Bag wine. It's better to sleep with. Speaking of, we need a Sotar commercial this time, don't we?
Oh, shoot.
Oh, yeah, our sponsor.
Hey,
Zach.
I'll do it.
I already did that with the ATV thing.
No, I'll do it. I'll edit it in the beginning.
There we go. All right, Aaron.
It's the only kayak that also doubles as a gearboat.
Aaron, we
want to go and the design makes a ton of sense.
Aaron, wrap this up, please.
Okay. Yeah, my Gear of the Week is legit gear. I got the Goal Zero 5 whatever X, so like their new lithium battery one, mostly because I'm boondocking these days and I was getting tired of paying so much for gas to, you know, work from the trailer. So I got that and it will power my computer, my second screen, and everything I need, like this little cell phone booster that I promoted last time. All day, no problem, getting me down only to 50%, and I'm saving, the way I calculated it, probably about $200 a month on gas. So, Goal Zero, Yeti 500X, I think it's called.
Aaron, I'm super confused. Why?
Yeah.
Why does it cost you gas to get electricity?
Because generators. Because I'm boondocking. Because I don't have any place to plug in. So
you're as the executive director of the Idaho African Gods Association, you're powering your laptop off of a gas generator.
Well, not anymore.
Now it's a solar panel. You were.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So that's why, Priscilla, to go back to just to tie this up, to bring it back to what's his name with the Oregon, like, totally not funded outdoor thing.
Office of Outdoor Rec.
Yeah, there it is. Office of Outdoor Rec. That's why I say, like, sympathy level, super low. Like,
because he has a
problem. I don't have outlets.
Because okay? He has an that's outlet. That's an outlet.
Yeah. Oh, does he have outlets?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm using the sun to power this movement, okay?
There we go. There's the podcast title.
Yeah. I'm going to write that down. That will be the title.
I'm using the sun to power this movement. I like that. All right. My gear of the week is the Big Agnes Big Six camp chair. It takes a bit of a college degree to set it up, but once you get that degree, then it's pretty easy after that.
That sounds good.
But it's super light, packs down super small, and is like insanely comfortable for a camp chair. So I've been really, really happy with it.
Sweet. Does it have a cup holder?
It does not have a cup holder. They have a different version. Mm-hmm. I think it's called the Big Six Armchair, which probably takes a master's degree to set up, but it does have an armchair, or wow. It does have cup holders.
Seems like a really high bar.
Yeah. So it's probably the same thing, but somehow you have to put in 15 more parts to get the arms. But super comfortable chair and packs down insanely small. So,
hey, can I get a quick survey from you guys of what you guys think the best breakdown table is? Like, you know, like, is it a roller table or is it something else?
It's basically blue roller table. There's a table I have that you can't buy anymore.
What's the criteria? Is it longevity, weight, impactability?
It's got to win across the board.
Blue. I think the blue roller table is the one that's closest. It is a bit heavy, but like all the other ones end up breaking like pretty shortly, I feel like. Like I like the Alps tables because they're super light aluminum, but they don't last very long. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason everybody else copies it.
Yeah.
Like, so awesome. Well, Aaron, thanks for joining us. You definitely made this episode a little meatier.
meatier. I thought you were misusing mediocre.
Interpret how you will.
Yeah.
You've
made our podcast very mediocre. Thank you.
Thank you for joining. You really, really lowered this bar.
Thanks. As we wind it down, I think the thing that we really want to hit on, if you didn't pick up anything else in this podcast besides the fact that we have the right answers to all of those questions, make sure you call your senator and tell them to support Senator Wyden's bill that's out there because it's great for the industry and great for public lands. And otherwise, it's raining on the West Coast. So get out in your backyard run and go boating. And there you have it. We'll see you next time when we probably will have an episode that's slightly more coherent and organized.